This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Follow Standard Orbit, Mr. Chekhov, and take us home.
Hi, sir.
It is the word of Landru.
Joy to you, friends, and thanks for joining us here in Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated show to the original series. My name is Drew, or Landru, and this is my co-host Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going over in the Trek Stars universe?
Well, it's going fine over in the Trek Stars universe. Aside from the fact that, like, I was on Twitter the other day, and I saw a thing where one of your friends was talking about how he's going to be down in Austin, Texas, over Valentine's Day weekend or something thereabouts, and they happen to be showing Boogie Nights at the Alamo Draft House down there.
Yes.
On 35mm, which is pretty much the best movie in the best format at the best venue you could possibly see it at. So basically, I mean, like when I saw that, like, because this is the type of thing that happens with me, like my initial reaction was like, how can I get down there? And then, you know, after like 30 seconds, I'm like, oh, no, I can't. Well, that's too bad. And, you know, I responded with something like, oh, my God, I'm so jealous. And then you chimed in and you're like, I wonder what I'll be doing while he's watching that movie, implying that you are going to be down in Austin, Texas when like the coolest cinema event in history is going to be occurring and that you're not going to bother with it.
No, I'm not.
That is absolutely cracking insane. I cannot deal with that. I just cannot deal with that. I'm sorry.
We made it 66 episodes and then our friendship was broken because of Boogie Nights.
I just don't understand. I really just don't understand.
I really don't need to see it again.
I think you really do need to see it again. That's
it's
the
not
whole
one
point.
Of those. It's not like 2001 where I'd give it another shot, you know, in 70mm or something, where I think that the format will actually enhance my appreciation of the film.
Okay,
I don't see how 35mm is going to help me appreciate Boogie Nights.
Okay, well, I disagree with that. For like a million reasons, but also that it is the type of movie that I think when you see it multiple times, you start picking up on things and you start putting together the pieces. When I first saw it, I was like, each individual scene is really good, but when you put it together, it doesn't really work. And then I listened to the commentary and I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. And then I watched it again and again and again and again. So listen to the commentary, and then just go from there.
Yeah, but Boogie Nights is the movie where I can't say that you've recommended that I watch a movie because Jessica will then not want to watch it. Is it anything like Boogie Nights? And I'm like, yes, Inherent Vice is from the director of Boogie Nights. And she's just like,
I mean, is that my fault or her fault? You know? I'm not sure, but Just do it. Just do it. Especially in that environment, like with an audience, you know, I think maybe you would find a greater appreciation for that movie.
Maybe.
And you need to tell me what it was like.
We'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right. Star Trek.
What's that?
It's a thing that we talk about occasionally.
I really don't know why. When we could be talking about Boogie Nights all the time.
No, we're not. This is not the Boogie Night Orbit.
It's
Boogie
bad.
Orbit.
It should be.
Dirk Diggler Orbit. Or whatever. I could do a Mark Wahlberg podcast.
Yeah? I don't know if I could. Although I did see The Gambler from Rupert Wyatt.
Yeah.
That movie's pretty cool.
I want to like that movie.
Did you see it?
No.
Oh.
No, but I want it to be good.
Oh, it is.
Maybe I'll convince Jessica to see it and not tell her that you recommended it.
All right.
All right, let's get started. Today we decided we would talk about movies, but the Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, the Star Trek movies that we're in control of, the original series ones. And we want to discuss the relative villains of said movies. How effective they were, how necessary they were, whether they were there at all.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting looking at the original series movies in particular, because there was sort of a different philosophy at that point in time as to whether or not you actually needed a quote-unquote villain. You know, there's a lot of people who are sort of critical of the movies today for saying, like, of course they need to have a villain because that's how movies are. Although I'd argue that that's how the original series was as well for the for the most part. It's kind of a weird time in the 80s where they said, like, maybe we don't need to do this. But, villains in Star Trek movies are weird.
Yeah. Especially considering how some of them aren't, most of them don't turn out to be villainous, really.
Yeah. They're complex. Sometimes.
They're very complex.
Sometimes.
Well, yeah. There's some straightforward ones. We'll start off with the motion picture, and the quote-unquote villain is V'ger. It's just a robot looking for its home.
Yeah.
Its creator.
And, I mean, I guess that's the thing about villains, right? Is, from their perspective, they're the hero, right? I mean, if it's a good villain, that's the way it's written, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, that's you always hear the actors, you know, talk about that. I mean, even, you know, we'll get to it later on, but Peter Weller talking about how he saw his character as the hero or a hero in Star Trek Into Darkness. But with the motion picture, you know, this is particularly true. And it's also kind of strange because we don't really know the villain's intentions throughout most of it. We don't even know if it's trying to be villainous. We just know that it's a threat.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I mean, what did you think about V'ger?
Yeah, the thing with V'ger is that it's not, I hate calling it a villain. And some of these I do hate calling a villain. It's more like the mystery of the week than it is that, I mean, V'ger does bad things, but I think that a villain is someone who does those bad things, like, on purpose for some goal. When it's goal, I mean, it digitizes all these people and ships and stuff, but it's not, it's doing it because that's its programming. I guess that brings into debate the, if you don't know you're doing bad things, does that make you a bad person?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the more appropriate term for this thing would be antagonist.
Okay.
But that doesn't really roll off the tongue as well, does it? Villain.
No.
Villain is the more marquee.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
antagonist is one of those, I mean, it's not like a $5 word or something. It's just, yeah, you normally hear about movie villains. Great movie villains. 101 movie villains according to AFI or something.
Yeah.
They don't call them antagonists.
Yeah, the AFI top 100 movie antagonists. Yeah. Doesn't quite work as well. But yeah, and once you do find out, you know, what V'ger is and what its programming is and why it's doing the things that it's doing, you actually have some sympathy for it. And you feel bad. And even though it went through and killed a bunch of people, it wasn't trying to necessarily. I mean, I guess it was trying to, but it just thought that it was doing, you know, what it should be doing. And also, you know, it sort of brings something else which is interesting into play, which is the fact that humans were the ones who programmed it. And through various external circumstances, you know, when it came back, it was just trying to do what the humans sent it out to do in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to call V'ger a villain, but it is definitely the antagonist, the foil for the hero of Captain Decker.
Yeah.
I mean Kirk. Spock. Too many captains.
Yep. The other thing which is kind of interesting about V'ger in relation to the other villains in Star Trek movies is that it's sort of the most non-human-like, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a robot or a ship which gained consciousness, and it comes back as sort of a almost non-corporeal being and that sort of thing. It's not like you can't even necessarily point to like a person or a face aside from maybe Ilea, which is, you know, the probe's face, but I mean it's you know, very out there in terms of the concept of a being.
Yeah. Probe Ilea doesn't really count as a villain. It's just, or even like a henchman.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, this is just a consciousness that is curious about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think obviously the reason why they even did that was so that they could give a face and a voice to this being, you know, something that we could relate to and the characters could relate to in, you know, sort of an easy to understand way on the screen, you know.
And it didn't help that she was attractive.
Yeah, that too.
It didn't hurt that she was attractive.
Yeah.
The second movie is a bit more straightforward. The second movie is called The Wrath of Khan, and it's about Khan wrathing.
Yeah.
And I think that it's definitely, to me, the most clear-cut villain. I mean, he's getting vengeance for a perceived slight against him for being a villain. It's not like Kirk, you know, condemned him to that planet because, you know, Kirk was being a butthead. He's, you know, he had every right to. He tried to kill the captain and take over the ship. But, I mean, sure, you could argue that, you know, his wife died and stuff, but his vengeance is overreaching, you know, torturing the regular space station people for information on Genesis, and now he's like going to threaten the whole universe with this weapon just because Kirk, you know, made him mad.
Yeah. You know, it's nice that with this one, unlike I think all of the other ones, we have a backstory, you know, in that it's kind of a sequel to an episode of the original series. And you can sort of build up why there is all this tension. Or you have it built up already so that you don't need to build it up throughout the course of the movie. And, you know, that helps, you know. And it also helps, I think, more than anything, to establish some sympathy for the character, in a sense. Because instead of needing to, you know, point out all the reasons why he's bad, you can kind of start with that and then point out some of the reasons why he's bad, you know, and by that I mean like the first time through, you don't have to say like, oh, look, he did this. You can say, oh, well, maybe the reason why he's mad is because his wife died or that sort of thing. And, you know, it makes it a more complex character. You know, I mean, he does have a point that Kirk said he was going to come back and check on him and he never did. And his wife ended up dying in the process, along with a bunch of other people, I'm presuming. And, you know, what Kirk did to him by marooning him on the planet, while maybe justified and maybe the only thing that Kirk could do, it could also be considered, like, cruel and unusual punishment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and apparently the fact that he never told Starfleet.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it's obviously, I think, like, when you look at it in terms of what a villain does for a story and how Khan is sort of an integral part of the story and really goes kind of head-to-head with Kirk throughout the movie. To me, this seems like a clear-cut case of the best villain in a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, he definitely makes the movie. Sometimes the villain is just there to be the antagonist, the guy who's poking the story forward. But, like, Khan is this movie.
Yeah.
And with any other character or with any other actor, it would not work as a movie.
Yeah, and it works so well that it sort of, like, crosses boundaries, and it makes the movie cross boundaries. Like, I really do think that the reason why so many, like, hardcore film people respond so well to Wrath of Khan is not because of all of the other stuff, but it's because of Khan, you know? I mean, like, there's this thing where, like, I mean, I think we've talked about this before, like, Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and all these guys consider it to be one of the best movies ever made. You know, in Kill Bill, it starts off with a quote from, well, it's attributed to Wrath of Khan. And, you know, it's the type of thing where, like, if you're looking for a Star Trek movie that's going to be playing it at, like, an art house, it's going to be Wrath of Khan, you know, yeah, and all this stuff. And lots of times when people refer to, like, revenge movies, they'll throw Wrath of Khan in there, whereas most revenge movies are things like Kill Bill, for example, which are told from the perspective of the person who is seeking revenge. Is this one's told from the perspective of the person who's having revenge sought on him? Is that how you say that? I don't know.
Sure. The vengee.
Right. And that's pretty cool that they're able to pull that off, because usually the people seeking revenge have a point because something bad was done to them. So I think that's pretty cool, you know? And, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with Khan's character and how well he's portrayed.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. Star Trek III, the title, Search for Spock, may make you think that Spock is the villain, but that's not true.
Mm.
Or Krug, I guess, is the villain?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, that's one of the... This is one of the Star Trek movies to me where it takes me a while to remember who the villain is, because the rest of the plot, like, he's just there and you'll forget about him for great periods of the movie, or at least I do. You get so absorbed in the, we found Spock, he's a child, that kind of thing. And then it's like, oh yeah, the Klingons are here too. And I don't know, is he is trying to preserve, to make sure that this isn't a weapon. And no one's giving them information about Genesis. I might argue that Krug isn't really a villain. I mean, he does bad things, but it's to gain... I mean, is he trying to gain control of Genesis or just understand it?
Well, I think both, you know? I don't think that he's trying to understand it. What he's seeing is, you know, what the information is presented to him regarding Genesis. He interprets that as saying that it's a weapon, even though all of the information, and these are like internal documents and everything, are saying, you know, it's not a weapon. It's designed as like a terraforming thing. And he's like, well, they can use it as a weapon. And also that's a great amount of power and I want it. So his thing is kind of twofold. Like, I don't want that to be in the Federation's hands, but also I want that power for myself to use it as a weapon, I think. So, I mean, I don't really see him as being a hero. You know, I see him as being villainous, yeah, especially when you see, like, the stuff that he does throughout. I mean, we're introduced to him because he gets information from a lady who I think in the novelization it's like his wife or girlfriend or something.
Yeah, I think so.
And because it's too dangerous to have that information out there, he blows up the ship that she's on. And then goes on his merry way, and he just sort of like continues doing that throughout the movie. He kills Savick and all this stuff. And
they kill what?
Oh, not Savick. He was going to kill Savick. He kills right. David. Yeah, same difference. And, you know, and that's a pretty villainous thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Like I said, I don't focus on him. The planet may be the villain, you know, the Genesis planet and it falling apart and speeding things up. And maybe, I mean, I never thought about any of this stuff to listen to your guys' commentary on Star Trek III. But, like, it's, I don't agree that the movie is, like, anti-science like Max does. But maybe mankind's hubris is the enemy. You know, like being, you know, using the proto-matter in order to cheat, maybe that's the villain. It's more the driving force than the Klingon.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that David is the villain, I guess, right?
Ooh.
Yeah. But I think where the weird part sort of comes in is that, you know, while the clear-cut villain is Krug, that's the B plot essentially, and the A plot is this planet which is dying, and you know, David, you know, is he a villain or not? I mean, he cheated, you know, and his cheating caused lots of death and destruction and everything like that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it was an accident, I guess. It was just bad science, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like he was trying to do this thing. It's just something that happened because he was being careless.
Yeah, he accepted the risks.
Yeah. And maybe he shouldn't have, or maybe it wasn't his place to. But yeah, I mean, it's the driving force behind this movie is the search for Spock. And you've got the ticking clock of the planet and all this stuff, and Krug is just sort of another element to all of that. And, you know, it's one of those things which, you know, we'll talk about later on as well, but lots of times people criticize movies, not just Star Trek movies, although they do this with Star Trek movies too, and they say, like, the villain is really weak. Like, that movie, I don't like that movie. The villain was so weak. You know, that happened with, like, Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff. And I'm just like, the villain, who was the villain? Because to me, it almost doesn't matter. You know, the thing that's important in this particular story is the voyage of the Enterprise and, you know, their mission to get Spock back and all that stuff. And the villain is just kind of like an element, but it's no more of an element than, you know, this ticking clock. I mean, you can say, like, well, I don't like the movie because the way that they had Genesis, you know, being destroyed was stupid. And, I mean, that's a legitimate criticism for this particular movie, but you never hear, you know, people really say that so much as, you know, like, it's almost like, you know, people feel like if the villain's not good, then the movie's not good. When in reality, the villain is oftentimes just a small part of something which is used to drive a story forward, which is almost necessary in order to, you know, have the other stuff in it, you know, but the other stuff is the important stuff. And that's kind of the case here, I think.
Yeah. I think that the movie would be just as effective without Krug.
Yeah.
Then, I mean, sure, maybe they wouldn't have tried to, you know, wouldn't have had to blow up the Enterprise to trick the Klingons, but I'm sure that that could have happened even without Krug being there.
Well, it certainly wouldn't be nearly as dramatic. You know, I mean, you've got the whole thing where once they get to the planet, you know, they're dealing with the fact that there's another ship in the area and, you know, the science ship has been destroyed or whatever, or, I mean, yeah, it's been destroyed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, they're trying to deal with all of these things. And I mean, that adds like a lot of tension, you know, even when they're down on the planet and everything. And since this is sort of like an adventure action movie, you know, I think that all of that is necessary. Otherwise, there would be like no conflict aside from the ticking clock for like the last hour or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
All right, so Krug, he's all right. Now, Star Trek IV, this is where we get really weird. Because the villain is a probe.
Yeah.
Of unknown origin that's trying, well, that is destroying Earth, but it doesn't seem to be doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
So really, and then once we go back in time to get the whales, the villain becomes primitive humans.
Yeah.
So we've got the military and doctors and people who won't give us transparent aluminum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this probably more than any other movie is the one that does not have a villain. Because even, like, it was very similar to V'ger. But, yeah. You know, I mean, here you've got, you know, this probe which is coming to Earth. It's trying to communicate with, you know, the whales, which is why the oceans are evaporating and causing havoc in the ecosystem, which is really weird. I don't see how that works. And, you know, it seems like they'd be messing things up for the whales if they were there.
Yeah, evaporating the Earth's oceans seems like you've got your communicator on too high.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, I don't think that the probe was sitting there saying like, oh, you killed the whales. We're going to blow up this planet now. You know, that's not what its intention was. It was just looking for the whales. But the whole time, I mean, obviously they don't know what the probe was saying either. But the whole time the implication is like, they just wanted to check up on them and make sure they were okay.
And yeah, it's that's like, the impression I've always gotten.
But if they're not okay, we're going to like do some massive damage to their ecosystem in the process of checking on them. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But
no.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is the driving force. I wouldn't even call it the antagonist.
No, not really. There isn't really an antagonist so much. I mean, there's like not a big one, but there's like little moments from scene to scene. And it's usually, you know, stuff where, I mean, none of these people can be considered villains. They're just doing what you would do in these situations. Because, yeah. I mean, if anything, like the crew of the Enterprise or the whatever, the Bounty, are the ones who are doing the wrong things.
Yeah, they are running around stealing a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters and
yeah,
and I mean the only thing that they don't steal is glass to build a
right. But even then, in order to get the glass, they give a guy a formula to build a technology which doesn't exist yet.
Are we saying that the Enterprise crew may be the villains in this movie, or at least the most villainous?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely the case. You know, they're anti-heroes in this movie.
Yeah.
From, you know, a 20th century perspective, at least. You know, once you get to the 23rd century, they become the biggest heroes because they save the world, you know?
As usual.
And surely, if the 20th century people knew what their intentions were, they would let them do their thing, but there's no way
they're not going to believe them.
Yeah. So, that's the way it works. I mean, even at the beginning of the movie, the reason why they're going back to Earth is to be put on trial because they did a bunch of bad stuff in the last movie too.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
I did not expect this.
But, you know, with Star Trek IV being the sort of whimsical, you know, comedy installment of the Star Trek movie franchise, it makes sense that there isn't really a hardcore villain in this. It's just sort of a plot device to get them to go back to the 20th century and talk about how the real villain is us, because we're destroying our world.
Yeah. Primitive humans, which is what I had down as the possible villain.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking of it because they were trying to stop the crew, but yeah, we are the villain because we hunted the humpback whale to extinction, which is illogical.
Yeah. And then if we hadn't done that, then the pro would have just shown up and been like, hey, guys, all right, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, but then the probe still would have, like, knocked out everybody on its way.
Oh, I mean, so what? So they have some interference in their little ships. You know, I mean, what? I guess they did say they were, like, losing life support or something, right?
Yeah, I think so.
But I'm sure they gained it back, right?
Yeah, maybe like, there's an effective range when you get too close to it, but then when it leaves, you power back up.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, they didn't really... I mean, I don't know how many people died because of the probe. I mean, surely some people died, right?
Oh, yeah. The Earth's oceans were evaporating. I'm sure that some people were on, like, cruises or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if there's no money. I mean, why not just cruise all the time?
Because, well, I
mean, and you can replicate whatever you want food-wise, so...
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess they... I don't know. They didn't have replicators back then.
Well, sure they did. They weren't, like, replicators like our replicators. By that, I mean 24th century replicators. But they had the little floppy disks, which, you know, they stuck into the thing and generated turkey dinners or whatever, coffee. Yeah.
The little...
cards. Little, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you were kind of limited in your options, but...
Well, we'll cover the other half of the original series villains in next week's episode.
Yeah.
Well, it was fun talking about the possible villains of Star Trek today, but that's just one of the Trek topics we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. Here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Because it's actually legitimately trying to say something.
Yes, very Star Trek. It may be the most Star Trek of all Star Trek.
Yeah, it's definitely what I would point to as being, this is what science fiction is about.
Earl Grey.
Kovac will tell us to experience bij sometimes, in which case we will draw the bij card, Klingon word for pain. So,
is it our birthday?
It is. It is. It's going to be a lot of fun.
To the journey!
That's the one thing we could take from Homecoming is, like, paragraph one, Chakotay and Seven break up. That's for real.
Yeah, they that shake happened. Hands and go, hey, it's been fun. It's been nice. Thanks for the picnic.
Eh, see then... ya.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Fair at this enough. Point, like, they could say, yeah, why not? Star Wars crossover. I would essentially say, fine. Both franchises are dead. Let's just sew them together and see what happens.
Melodic Treks.
One of the most well-thought-out alien races that you only see in one episode.
Yeah, and the music is it's menacing without being over-menacing, if that makes sense.
Axanar, the official podcast.
I think Justin Lin is a fascinating choice to direct because the Fast and the Furious movies, even though, yeah, they're action-adventure road race movies, are really about a family.
The 602 Club.
That's really cool, though. I mean, I think that is a fantastic way to get to see just about any movie is kind of being able to watch it through a kid's eyes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the daily Trek Talk. You find them on iTunes, Stitcher, Spreaker, SoundCloud, or you can stream from the website. Just visit Trek.fm/podcast to get all the links. All right, we got a message from Christopher in Tarpon Springs, Florida, which he notes is the little town which is destroyed in Star Trek Enterprise. That was a banner day.
Mm.
I'm not sure what he means by that.
It will be a banner day.
Says, hello, Drew and Mike. I'm a new fan of Trek FM and especially Standard Orbit. I am, however, an old fan of the Star Trek universe. Also, I am disabled, both physically and visually. Have you ever thought of joining with Earl Grey in discussing episodes which focused, at least in part, on disabled characters and storylines? Characters might include Christopher Pike, Geordi LaForge, or Worf when he had his own pity party after being paralyzed. Some Klingon warrior. Anyways, this is just an idea. Also, does anyone remember the original series movies on VHS that formed a picture of the Enterprise when all six movies were collected and placed in order? That was probably a gimmick, but I thought it was pretty nifty. You guys are awesome, and each of your episodes helped me to forget my challenges. Your new fan, Christopher.
Thanks, Christopher. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad that we can bring some joy to you.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's one of those things where, like, lots of times we're recording this stuff and... You know, I mean, the cynical me, I always think, like, no one's listening. No one's listening to us at all. You know, why are we even doing this? It's just, we're just, you know, entertaining ourselves. But, you know, when you hear stuff like this, you know, that really makes me happy. Yeah, in terms of, like, doing an episode on, you know, that topic, I never really thought about it. Have you?
I have not. But there is some discussion behind the scenes of having theme weeks.
Yeah.
Where each one of our shows covers something like that. And I'll bring up disabilities to the group, because we've got Pike, we've got the lady in Is There in Truth No Beauty, mm-hmm. or in Beauty No Truth, or whichever episode that is. There's a lot of it. We could probably make an episode of that.
Yeah, it seems like Next Generation really does deal with it the most. You know, Deep Space mm-hmm. Nine touches on it a little bit too. But yeah, it seems like Next Generation is really sort of the one where they tackle those issues more than any other show.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And I never owned the VHS set, but my friends did.
Yeah, I had it. I had all those. I bought them individually. They came out when Star Trek V, I don't know if it was when Star Trek V was released, or I don't know if it was released when they were promoting Star Trek VI. I think maybe it was for the 25th anniversary. So when you had the first five movies, they formed the picture. And then when you bought the sixth movie, which came out a few months later, it extended the picture into nothing.
Yeah, the starburst thing. That's what I thought was really clever about it, is that they obviously made it with the first five movies in mind, but then the sixth movie is there, and they didn't just, like, abandon the concept. They were like, okay, here's a little bit more of the side of the picture. Kind of like nothing. The Friends in HD that I'm watching. The picture doesn't, the extra picture on the side doesn't really add anything to it. There's just more empty space.
Yeah, yeah. And for the laser discs, that was the cover which was used for the widescreen versions. But with the laser disc, instead of having it all make a picture, since the spines were, you know, super duper thin, they just took that, like, big image and sort of put it behind the picture on for the actual movie. So,
oh, okay.
So the each of the laser disc jackets is exactly the same in terms of that design. But
it's a good picture. I like it.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
Well, if you'd like to contact us and share your thoughts on today's show or any of the shows, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send a show and choose Standard Orbit. That'll come to both of us by email. You can also use the tab on the left-hand column of any page to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone. And you can talk to us and our other listeners at our Facebook group, The Babel Conference. In social media, you'll find our Facebook page at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Mike, where can people find you out of orbit?
You can find me right here on Trek FM doing commentary Trek Stars with Max and John. And you can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com doing commentary Trek Stars off topic with Max and Brandon. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
And you just celebrated your 500th episode of commentary.
Commentary Track Stars Productions, I guess, is how the best way to phrase it is. You know, like, if you take the four shows that we've done, you know, from sort of a production standpoint, not necessarily that we've always been on or anything like that, but the ones that we've, you know, started up on our own and then produced. All the way through, we just hit our 500th episode. We did a thing where we tried to include a little bit of everything, including commentary Trek Stars, by discussing Justin Lin's work on Community and providing a commentary for one of his episodes. So go over to commentarytrackstars.com and check it off. There's a Back to the Future 2 commentary on there as well.
It's very good. Oh. I listened to the Back to the Future commentary already.
Thanks.
No problem. You can find me on Twitter at 005, DUBLEOFIVE, and on like five or six of those commentary Track Star episodes.
Yeah.
100th, probably.
But not on Boogie Nights. Not on that one.
Nope. Maybe we can do a commentary where you explain why the movies should be good.
I would love to do that. Anytime. Just let me know.
At this time, we'd like to thank Richard Rutledge Jr. for being our associate producer this month. You can find him on Twitter at RUT8972, and we really appreciate him supporting us on Patreon.
Yeah, I was like, what? Someone likes us enough to produce us? That's crazy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. And then I told my wife, and she's like, what?
Yeah. So thank you very much, Richard. We really appreciate it.
We really do.
Yeah.
Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring Standard Orbit to you each week, and our sponsor for the show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers and even some of those famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World, Audible has something for everyone. Mike, what do you have for everyone?
Well, I have Star Trek The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan, Noonien, Singh, which is, you know, as we discussed, you know, probably the best of the Star Trek movie villains. It is written by Greg Cox. It's narrated by Anthony Stewart Head. It's the guy from Buffy, right?
Yeah.
All right. It's 3 hours long. And they say here on Audible.com, even centuries later, the final decades of the 20th century are still regarded as one of the darkest and most perilous chapters in the history of humanity. Now, as an ancient and forbidden technology tempts mankind once more, Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise must probe deep into the secrets of the past to discover the true origins of the dreaded eugenics wars, and of perhaps the greatest foe he has ever faced. And you can get this book for free since you listen to Trek FM.
That's right. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today, catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read, and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Standard Orbit and Trek FM. And lastly, there's another way you can keep us in orbit, and that's by supporting us on Patreon, like Richard. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find a list of donation levels where you can get things like exclusive digital goodies, early access to episodes, access to our project manager, and even be listed as an associate producer in our shows. You'll find out where the donations can go, things like covering the monthly cost of hosting and distribution, hiring an editor for our shows, and upgrading our equipment. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm, so check it out. That was the first part of the villains of the movies. So join us next week where we conclude our discussion. So everybody, thanks for listening. Have a good week and keep on trekking. It is the will of Landry.
Mr. Chekhov, take us out of orbit. Ahead, warp factor 1.
Hi, sir.